Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming out. Welcome. My name is Dubs Weinblatt. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. And I am so excited to be here for our 8th season of the Thank You for Coming Out podcast. In 2015, I founded the queer improv show Thank You for Coming Out, or TIFCO as we call it, and it was one of the longest running queer improv shows in New York City. In 2018, our beloved improv show became the podcast it is today, hosted and produced by Gay City News. It is an honor and privilege to hold space for the coming out and coming into self stories our guests share. And I am so excited about my guest here with me today, met on the internet, and now we are friends IRL, even though we haven't met IRL. Cantor Laura Stein, she, her, grew up in the New York Reform Jewish community where she discovered her love of Jewish music. She received her Master of Sacred Music and her ordination from Hebrew Union College. She also holds an MSW from New York University. Laura obtained her clinical social work license while working at Mount Sinai Hospital's Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery. Currently, she is a PhD candidate in practical theology at Boston University. Her doctoral, how do you say that? We'll talk about that later. Research is in the psychology of religion with inquiry into how Jewish clergy experience their formation. She is passionate about exploring how people live religious values, aligning DEI and justice beliefs with lived experience and ways of turning religious trauma into healing and thriving. In her free time, she enjoys watching documentaries and attending Broadway musicals, spending time with her nibblings, and following the Indigo Girls on tour. She's seen them over 350 times. That is bonkers. I can't wait to talk about that. Laura, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. How are you? First of all, where are you and how are you?
So physically right now I'm in Westchester, just outside the city. I do spend half the week in Boston where I'm finishing up my PhD, finishing up in quotes because, you know, that's been a process and it's a slow one, but I'm looking about a year out, hopefully, to have my dissertation finished. And I spend the rest of my time here in New York where I work with mostly Jewish community members who are unaffiliated, officiating weddings and meeting people where they are to bring meaningful experiences of Judaism to their life cycle and life transitions.
Amazing. How did you, well, you know what, I'll get to that. But, okay, and so is the weather as lovely in Westchester as it is in Brooklyn?
It's funny, you know, I just asked Alexa and it's 49 degrees here, supposed to get up to 64, but I'm headed into the city later and it said that in the city it's already 55 degrees. So yes, it is beautiful and going to be even more beautiful as I travel into the city a little later today.
Amazing. Yeah, it's 54 here right now, it says. And so
amazing.
It's thrilling. What are you doing in the city?
Today, I am meeting with my accountant. I am also going to visit my grandmother, who's 97, who I love very much. We're very close. And then I am going to meet with a wedding couple to do some premarital counseling. They're getting married later this year.
Wow, cool. 97 years old.
She's New York City born and bred, still has that Queens accent. She's just very, very special person to me.
That's amazing.
What
a
and
blessing
I
to
can
still
share
have.
later.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I can share later how important she's been in my Jewish journey specifically and in my cantorial process as well.
Definitely. I was just saying, what a blessing to have a living grandparent.
It really is. It really is. So much to say about that. But I'm so grateful that she's not only physically still with us, but she's still with it. And we talk, I will say, of all the people in my life, she was the most queer affirming in her 80s, which I hate to say that age really has to do with how, accepting people are or should be. But she said to me something along the lines of, life is hard enough. If you do it alone, it's even harder. You just need to find someone you love. And she talked about my grandfather who had died when I was in high school and how meaningful their 50 plus year marriage and relationship was, and was really just affirming of this idea that love is love. And I have to say, when Trump started attacking trans rights, she printed out articles and showed them to me and said, how could he do this? She really, I think, was ahead of her time in terms of her own compassion and her own love for people transcending, what she may have been taught or the culture that she grew up in.
It's amazing. That's so nice to hear. Do you think that now we're just getting sidetracked, but I'm very interested. Do you think being born and raised in New York City, is like as a such a progressive, open, diverse place, like had an impact on how she views the world?
I do on the one hand. On the other hand, she was part of a very traditional culture. She went to NYU where she majored in home economics, a program that I don't think exists anymore, where women would live together in an apartment and learn how to run a household and get graded on it. And that was part of their, that was her degree, was learning how to basically take care of her husband and her family. And
Wow.
on the one hand, I think that was probably, instilled a lot of traditional values in her. I do think she was exposed to some progressive ideology as well, but I really believe that it was her love for me and her own experience of knowing what true partnership can add to a person's life. I have to say, when I started working in the transgender community, she was very interested to learn. She would say things to me like, I have so much compassion in my heart for what it must be like to be born in the wrong body. I mean, she was not always necessarily using all the most PC language, but she was trying to express just kind of this common humanity of what it's been like for her to go through life with the ups and downs that came her way and trying to have empathy for what that must be like for other people in their journey. And I, my dad and I looked at each other, and she's my dad's mom, and at some point said, kind of, where did this come from? And agreed that, you don't have to be taught to love. It's really the most basic instinct that we all have. And I think she drew on that instinct when she was approaching me and the broader queer community.
Wow. Give your grandma a hug for me.
I will tell her about this experience later. I'm assuming she'll say, what's a podcast? But I will be very happy to explain to her and to tell her that her wisdom and her lessons hopefully will bring some healing to some other folks and some hope to people who are listening, that that support networks can be chosen family, they can be our immediate family, but that love can really be found anywhere where people are willing to listen and learn.
That's the whole podcast, everybody. Just kidding. That's
We done? We
beautiful.
wrapping up?
Yeah, we're wrapping up. That was great. Can't top that. Okay, well, that's lovely. Okay, so we all have multiple coming out stories, coming into self stories. And so I would love to hear one that you'd like to share.
Sure. I will start by saying that the phrase coming out, as I'm sure a lot of people feel, is just riddled with dominant kind of culture control that I really object to. So that's not a phrase that I've ever really used. I use it colloquially because it's hard at a party to correct people to use the phrase that I'm prefer, but I prefer this phrase getting out, which I heard, I wish I could remember where I heard it first. I heard it somewhere in queer community, but coming out of the closet, this idea that you are somehow stuck and it's so dark and you have to let yourself be free and liberate yourself. I think for me, it gives a lot of power to a lot of other people. So I use the phrase getting out, which again, like I said, is hard at a party to say, I got out when I was, 20 or whatever, that maybe it sounds like you were getting out of prison or some other setting that you really wish to be free from. But in this case, the way that I use it is to say that I really felt my whole life very oppressed by straight culture that I was forced to live in because it's the dominant culture that we all live in. And it was getting out of that really allowed me to live in this world as the person who I am. So that's the first thing is I will probably say got out instead of come out throughout the podcast. My getting out story is a slow burn. It's kind of as Ernest Hemingway said in Sun Also Rises, something like gradually then suddenly. For me, it was suddenly then gradually. I knew from when I was four, the first time I understood maybe gender or sexuality or attachment in any way, I knew that I was a lesbian. The process of getting out of the culture that wanted me to be something different was a slower burn, not because I wished for it to be, only because, you only have so much control over your ability to shape the environment around you. So my process has been one of, I think I was describing this last night to my partner, trying to say, how do I describe this story? And thinking about the fact that I was deeply in love with some cisgender men in my earlier years, very connected, not at all lying about our relationships or my love for them, but really at the same time holding this theoretical understanding of myself. And I have to say, I never knew that being a lesbian could be a practical reality in my life. I thought it was theoretical. I was describing this to my partner last night, and I'm sorry if this is a weird analogy, but I was saying, I know that the dinosaurs existed in theory. I can conceive of them, but it's impossible for me to imagine what it would have been like to have them on Earth. Humans didn't exist at the same time, obviously, but if they were somehow here the way we see squirrels running across, darting across the street, it'd be so hard to understand practically what that looks like. But theoretically, of course, I accept them as part of history. And I think the same thing was true. I always projected into my future this theoretical understanding of my identity, but never could conceive of and just didn't believe that it would ever be a practical reality. Not that I even said, oh, I wish it were. It just, those dots never connected. Of course, I wished that it were, but it just didn't feel ever like a reality that would be. And so gradually over time, I think as the culture changed, my understanding of what was possible for myself changed as well. But my getting out story really, I think, pivoted when I met a partner when I was in cantorial school. And, again, I was thinking about this last night and trying to understand what was it about that relationship that enabled this getting out transition for me or this pivotal moment. And when I think about it, it was the ability to express everything I had been holding for 25 years. My identity was growing and forming and shaping inside of me slowly over time as I put the puzzle pieces together of who I was, the same way we do as young people in many dimensions of our lives. And the ability to finally express that when I met someone, a woman, a cisgender woman who I fell deeply in love with, the practicality, the practical reality, the applied sort of learning I'd been doing my whole life really came to be in a way that I finally got out, so to speak. I called my parents literally, I think, 5 minutes after she and I kissed for the first time, and I just said, hi. I was living in Israel at the time, and we only had Skype, and I remember just saying, I just wanted to tell you I'm a lesbian, gotta go, bye. And for whatever reason, that just felt like I had finally gotten out of this culture that I felt really wanted me to be different than I was. And so slowly, throughout the years I've been building, I think a lot of people talk about coming out or getting out as kind of starting over. It's like reliving your adolescence and learning the ropes of love in a new way. If I think about it that way, then I spent a lot of my 20s and 30s joining queer community, learning about what's out there, meeting other people, and that's been, I guess, the final stage is connecting to community and giving back in that way, so that kind of the journey comes full circle.
Nice. Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate the distinction between coming out and getting out. And a few seasons into this podcast, I added coming into self as part of the description because, if people have so many different ways of connecting with themselves and the world around them. I was interviewing, this was, I think it was the first season, and I was interviewing this woman named Chloe, and she was talking about, because I had talked about being like assigned female at birth, and she rephrased it as like forced female at, and I was like, yeah, it really was a forcing. It wasn't just like a benign assignment. It was very powerful, a very powerful assignment. So I also have it like just like relating to your story, this like slow burn, except mine's a little bit different, which is like I also knew from like very early consciousness, like something is different about me. I didn't have the language or the understanding around it. I definitely was like, when I saw other family structures, I was like, mine's gonna look different. And but also didn't realize that I was not knowing about my gender and like questioning th I didn't know that you could do that. Which I think kind of ties into the like the theoretical versus the practical of like, is this a thing? Like, can it, is this, can I do that? And just like for me though, there was like you had said like there was no kind of like wishing. It just like it was just like theory versus like for me, I like wished every second of every day. Like I was tortured. I was tortured like my whole life trying to find myself and where I could fit in, not really even knowing where to look or how to look. And I appreciate the dinosaur analogy. I think that's helpful of like, is this like, what would that even be like to experience this in this way? Okay, so how did you, okay, so you met the first person, this first woman that you were in love with, and you smooched, and then you're like, hold on a second, I gotta call my parents. So how did your parents react to your quick Skype call?
Well, it's funny because I had been really connected to this particular woman. My parents knew about her. I think everyone just thought we were like best friends. We were very fast friends, met, and immediately, I mean, I thought it was love at first sight. My parents, I think, and the outside world just saw that as, two girls who click. So when I called them, I said, I actually am dating a woman. And my dad said, oh, is it? And then named her. And I said, yes, actually it is. And my dad said, oh, I was kidding. And I was like, oh, well, I'm not. And it's pretty smooth sailing from there. I'm very, very lucky, to have parents who I don't even want to say who accept me, because again, that is kind of is in the category of like coming out language to me. It's like I needed their approval. They had to accept me. It's I really had parents who love me and who want me to be happy, whether that's in my physical health and my mental health. They helped me, attend college and graduate school, and they've been supportive of my self-actualization, and I didn't really see this as being any different from them just being on the journey with me. So I was very lucky in that way. There were some struggles that came after that, but certainly I can give a lot of credit and should give a lot of credit to my immediate circle of family and friends who, some people, most people said to me, like, yeah, I knew this already. And I was like, oh, great. Okay. So now we can talk about it. In that it wasn't necessarily a surprise, I think because the way I've always inhabited the world has been one of queer perspective. I've always been a person who challenges normativity. I've always been a person who questioned structures and systems, and It didn't necessarily hurt the narrative that up until that point I'd seen Indigo Girls, I don't know, 200 times or
I was
whatever. So
just gonna ask.
by the time I got out, people would say, yeah, like we get it. But I would say, not that you asked, but I'll share a story that, it was affirming on the one hand, to be seen in the explicit and also the implicit ways, or the kind of spoken and unspoken ways that that came together without having to do a lot of stitching together of narrative for people. And of course, there were moments that it wasn't like that. I can share two stories if that's okay with you.
That's why we're here.
Okay, so before I got out, when I was working at a synagogue here in New York, in the city, this was in 2010, 2011. I was deep in my Indigo Girls. I mean, I had followed them around in college, missing class and going in to see them. So it wasn't necessarily a new stage, but I was, living on my own and had some money to spend and was following them more intently. And that was kind of clear at my job where I was working as an educator at a synagogue. And the cantor said something to me, which I will never forget. And to be honest, I'm hoping to talk to her about it now that I'm older and want to kind of let go of that pain. But she said to me, "Indigo girls, aren't they kind of fruity?"
Oh no.
And I think about this a lot. She's a colleague of mine now. We are obviously both cantors. I was not a cantor at the time. I don't know what she meant by that, and I want to ask her what she meant. What I know is that it was a pejorative question, right? That the word fruity, unless you're describing a delicious slushy, is not usually meant as a compliment. I don't know how I brushed that off. I will say it definitely lives with me. Like I remember it, and it was painful, but it didn't stop me. I started to play Indigo Girls a little louder in the office after that. I felt kind of empowered. And I'll tell just another short story that I think, again, definitely it's in some ways was crushing in that it made me feel a little small. But I think once I reinflated after that, I felt even more empowered. Is that I went to my high school reunion many years ago, my 10-year reunion, 10 years ago, I just had my 20th. So 10 years ago, I went to my 10-year reunion and saw a friend from childhood, and she was like, "What's new with you? And how are you? And tell me about your life." And I got out to her. I said, "I'm a lesbian. I'm dating my partner. We've been together for, so many years by that point." And she basically looked at me and she's like, "Oh, I don't care." And it was dark, it was loud, we were drinking. It was like hard to know how to respond. But I understand now through my social work training, my doctoral training, that identity minimization is a real thing. Identity dismissal is a real thing. And there's actually a term for this. We might call it being colorblind or whitewashing if we're talking about racial differences or neutralizing differences or erasure, of course. But there's a term, micro invalidation, and what happened with the fruity comment would be like a microaggression. It was aggressive, kind of against the Jewish culture. It was a way to kind of nick us in a small way. It was obviously meant to be offensive.
A Jewish
This girl who
culture
I
or
spoke
queer culture? Saying fruity.
what did I say?
You said Jewish culture. But saying fruity was like a nick at towards the Jewish
Oh,
culture.
sorry. That calling somebody fruity is a nick against us as queer people and queer kind of theology of looking out into the world and seeing gender without hierarchy and seeing gender, as part of the human experience and not a big difference among people. Although, even though that was a slip of mine and I misspoke, I will also say I do think it's a nick against Jewish culture in that if Judaism really is meant to be a place of really living B'Tselem Elohim, we are all created in the image of God, and in that way we are all holy and we are all equal. That was I think a violation of Jewish theology too. And of course, it go, kind of maybe goes without saying that as an aspiring cantor and someone who was raised with a great belief in the power of Jewish living and being guided by Jewish theology and values, that hearing that from a Jewish professional in a Jewish setting was really hard for me. And we can kind of get back to that later. But back to my friend from childhood. This micro invalidation, which I really do believe she meant as a validation. I think she meant to say, oh, I don't care. You're just like me. I'll tell you about my boyfriend. You'll tell me about your girlfriend. So good to see you after all these years. We are the same. We're both succeeding as professionals in New York City. That's what I think she meant to say. But this idea of minimizing difference, intentional or otherwise, is to not give a person the chance to say, what makes me different is what makes me unique. And in that way, I'd actually like to celebrate it instead of minimize it. And I will share just a short anecdote that my best friend from childhood, she will say, or my closest like family friend from childhood, I told her about this story afterwards. She was there as well at the reunion. And we kind of use it now. Like, she says that her husband, she'll say to her husband something serious, like, oh, like, the air conditioning is broken. And he'll be like, who cares? I don't care. Just like as a way to like, respond in this way that's like, we have to do better. It's kind of become a joke. And I don't mean to insult this girl. I really do think she was trying, but there's a lot of stuff about allyship that I think speaks to how uneducated a lot of people are about really what it means to let somebody else guide how they speak about themselves and not to project your own anxiety about what difference looks like.
Yeah, there's a lot of I'm just thinking of like when I'm kind of like going back a little bit further of like when people were saying to you like, oh yeah, I knew. I had people say that to me when I would come out in various ways, and that also felt invalidating or somehow of just like I don't know, like, well, A, I was like trying to hide it. So the fact that you could still see it didn't feel good. And also, I don't know, I can't quite put to words why it felt invalidating. Maybe you know why I felt invalidated in that moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know obviously what your experience was, but I can say for me that it felt like people were saying, we knew you better than you knew you. And I had spent so much time with myself. Not hating myself. I had spent so much time celebrating myself that when people had this kind of pity of like, oh, it's so nice to see that you're finally growing up. I took it as a little condescending. And again, I really don't believe that people meant it that way. I mean, it depends on how people said it. For some people, they were like, oh my God, can we like finally talk about XYZ? Because I just want to talk about this with you. And it was like they were kind of waiting for me to give them permission to be a full friend with me. And I think that that was great for some people, especially like the way that they said it. I think language obviously can be the difference between the way that we feel about certain things. So, I think that was great. But also, some people saying it in a way that felt like I had ownership over your identity until you came back to claim it is kind of how it felt to me. Like, this was mine until you were finally ready to take it. And I kind of felt like, no, this was always mine. You just took it from me. Like, you, not you, my friend, but you, as a member of heteronormative straight culture, you took it from me by calling my music fruity or telling me that, or asking me when I came back from summer camp, did you kiss any boys this summer? Instead of saying, did you have a crush on a person this summer? Asking an open question that would allow me to respond with the truth of my own story. So it's complicated. And over time, I think I've cultivated some forgiveness for the ways in which people tried, because I really do believe that people tried their best.
Okay, so I have a question. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it. So I'm holding what you just said of like people are really trying to do their best, which I genuinely believe that at least in my experience, mostly people are trying to do their best. And then something you said earlier about just like how people are uneducated as it comes to, as it relates to how to be an ally and what, and like what to say. And to me, and I'm curious what you think, I feel like the phrase uneducated can be prickly. And it, and to me, it's also kind of like it counters the idea of I don't know what I'm trying to say. Like, you know, like I feel like someone who genuinely wants to do well but doesn't know how feels you know, versus someone's uneducated. You know what I mean? Like, do you see what I'm saying? Like, I'm curious, like, if there's a difference in your mind or how we
Because
can,
uneducated feels like a choice.
no, I think uneducated feels, maybe it feels like a choice. And I also think maybe, and this might just be my own stuff, but maybe I think it might feel, like it, like condescending or like a little dig at somebody of like, well, you're uneducated, so you don't know, versus like someone who is like, I'm trying, I don't know what I don't know. So I don't know. It might just be like, you know, 'cause we're talking about the power of language. And so I'm just genuinely curious, like if you see a difference in the ways in which that's framed, or if I'm just particularly like alerted to it somehow.
Definitely. The first thought I'm having is I wish we could pause and like come back tomorrow because you know that thing that happens when you talk a lot and then later you're like, oh, I should have said that. You know, I meant to say this or I hadn't thought about it in the moment. So I can say what's coming to mind now. I'm sure I have more to say about this that, you know, I'm not thinking of because I didn't know, you know, that we'd be talking about this component necessarily. I don't mean it as a dig against people to say that they're uneducated. I mean that I think more about culture than about individuals. I think you're right that the word uneducated can make it seem like people aren't taking their responsibility seriously to learn how to care for each other. And I don't generally think that that's true, at least not in my community. I've been very lucky to be surrounded by people who I think do take that responsibility pretty seriously. I can't speak to the broader culture that we live in right now, which is, you know, objectively just terrible. But I think that what I mean by that is our straight, heteronormative, cisgender, white Christian dominant culture. Sorry if I'm missing a privilege that I did not name, male. That culture doesn't foster a sense of curiosity about other people. So maybe curiosity is the better word than uneducated or educated. That you don't need to know the right words. You don't need to, I mean, you know, we can't expect everybody to understand what it's like to be another person or to have the best reference point to use all the proper language and other things like that. But to be curious and to want to learn based on what you hear from other people. So I guess I would, instead of saying uneducated, I would say uncurious or incurious. I don't know what the technical grammatical word is. It probably isn't
What? But
one,
you
but
love grammar. How
I
do you
love
not
grammar. I
know?
know my dad is gonna like rake me over the coals for this. He's gonna be like, you know, he'll rake me over the coals not because I didn't know this, but because I didn't stop this podcast, look it up, and then correct myself. No, I'm kidding. You know, I think maybe that's a good reframing. So thank you for challenging that because I think, you know, uneducated might imply that people are ignorant, or that they wish not to know more. And I don't think that that's true, but I do think that our culture, you know, just like that story from my reunion, I think that our culture is polarized. There's a total dismissal of people and there's a total acceptance of people. I don't know that there's a middle ground always of I'm curious about what this means for you and how I can best be there for you. And this actually leads me to something that I learned during my PhD. I know we haven't talked that much about that part of my life, but I've been in this doctoral program for the past 5 years in a learning as a Jewish person in a Christian setting, because of the specific research I was looking to do, I found myself in a Methodist setting, which has been incredibly eye-opening for me in a lot of ways. Somebody taught me in that setting that, this phrase that we might say, oh, the golden rule in Judaism, on one foot, the kind of what's the Torah about? And we say it's about, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. And another way that maybe the Christians talk about it is treat others as you want to be treated. And somebody taught me this thing, which is treat others as they want to be treated. And this idea that you don't project how things would be for you. Ideally, I would prefer that you X towards me or Y towards me, but that there's a curiosity in saying, I don't want to treat you as I'd want to be treated because we have different lived experiences. I want to treat you as you want to be treated. So what does that mean for you? So I think that that pairs well with your question about educated and maybe my response about curiosity is that, I really wish for the world, but more specifically, my local community, specifically the Jewish community that I spend most of my time in, to really understand this virtue of curiosity, to be interested in other people, their lived experience, as a way to, I don't want to say become more educated, but as a way to become better at caring for one another. This phrase in Hebrew, sakranut, this virtue, part of like the Musar canon and part of our broader understanding of how Jews are supposed to be. I don't know that we give enough attention to that. And I don't know how to educate people on that myself to say like, as Jews, we are meant to be, we are meant to treat each other as neighbors, and we are meant to treat people as we wish they would treat us, but there's another layer to that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I appreciate you going on that little journey with me. And I want to just kind of highlight what we did, which was you said something, and I got curious about it and asked you a question. And instead of getting defensive, you really heard me and we had a conversation about it. And I think if more people could have interactions like this, which is, back to the whole curiosity thing of like help me understand, instead of getting mad at you or canceling you or shutting you out, I got curious about what you meant by it. And I think if we had more of that dialogue, we could be in a much better place generally.
Yeah, I mean, case in point, I think we both walked away with like a broader, more expansive understanding, which is really all you can hope for. And here's my little plug for Jewish values or Jewish living, or like what my whole PhD is about how we align Jewish values with our living is that with the way we live is that you can be guy. I mean, sure, becoming defensive is kind of a neurobiologic response. It's an unconscious response in a lot of ways, but we can make choices, or we can be intentional about how we train ourselves to listen and how we train ourselves to, put down our defenses so that we can understand that someone isn't attacking us and whatever. And that modeling that we just did, not to pat ourselves too much on the back, but that's been learned for me. I wasn't born understanding how to do that, but that's, I think, been a gift that I've been given from my experiences, both positive and negative experiences, in all of my communities, but specifically in the Jewish community, of learning to say, if I'm so intent on all of this stuff and I don't want to be moralistic about it, the point isn't to try to be holier than thou in this way, but really just to say, we can do this differently. Like let's try it out. Let's model that. And so I'm really glad that this happened because I'm going to be thinking about this for a while, and I imagine my language will change because of how you introduced me to a new perspective. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I also this is learned for me too of like I went through a lot of life feeling very defensive and being very defensive, and I'm sure it's tied up in feeling like I was stuck somewhere I couldn't get out of and trying to assimilate into normativity and got upset if people questioned it and I think also I worked at Keshet. For those of you listening who don't know what that is, a nonprofit that works with Jewish organizations on LGBTQ inclusion and belonging. And I would go into different Jewish spaces all over the country, educating folks on, queerness, and a lot of, and most of the time it was on identities that I hold. And so I had to really learn as a facilitator, to not get defensive when people would say things, either genuinely curious or maliciously, like just how to hold space and how to get curious and how to respond in those moments. And it really changed how I move through the world and how I interact with people, of really just like just always getting curious of like, say more about that. Like, what do you mean? And so, I don't know. It's just,
I'm loving because my partner and I have a joke where, like, say more, because I'm a therapist, and so in addition to being a cantor, and say more is like something that I use in therapy all the time, but started to use in our romantic relationship. And it's become such a joke where, like, we're like radically curious, or she'll be like, "Oh, this cookie is so good," and I'll be like, "Say more." Can you say more about that? And she'll be, and then it's kind of like this thing of like, you can never be too curious about what someone else is experiencing.
It's always, I love therapy, and I'm in it, and have been in it for a very long time, and have learned, like, because my therapist all the time would be like, say more about that. And I'm like, I would hate to, but I will. It's just love, like, say more about that. And then there were also moments too where I had to, I feel like it's always a learning process of finding the line of kind of, holding someone's hand through this like journey of learning versus you're actively harming me right now, and I'm gonna stop it. And I don't need to get curious in this moment because I know what you're saying. I know why you're saying what you're saying, and it's not productive. So it's
And
a lot of learning there.
definitely, I think any, I'm going to use the word virtue in English, but we might call it a midah, Judaism, like any trait, any soul trait that is meant to help us live well is needs to be contextualized within boundaries that keep people safe. And so that's why we have hopefully a lot of time, a long journey to do that with each other so that we can keep practicing.
For sure. Okay, so you've seen the Indigo Girls 350 times or more.
Something like that, yeah.
First of all, how do you know? Do you have all your ticket stubs?
How do I know? I don't. I spent a summer in college looking at data from every single concert that they've ever performed and comparing it with my own personal data from credit card statements. I mean, this was like a big project. And since then I've been tallying it since then, yeah.
That's
Yeah.
amazing.
So I was in the Village Voice. My best friend and I were in the Village Voice because of this fact. Doesn't exist anymore, but we have the screenshot of the article, and that was in 2010 when we went to the second iteration of Lilith Fair. I saw Emily Saliers a few weeks ago, as you know from my Instagram, and I asked her, "How many times have I seen you?" And she was like, "I don't know."
You asked her that? Because you were nervous, or you were making a joke, or
No, she knows me. I mean, I'm around, and she was kind of like, "I don't know, you're around, like you're kind of always here." Not in a creepy way. I mean, we have like a nice relationship, the only way that you can when you're like a crazy fan and people, have to be careful of you. But she did say to me, she's like, "You're a really, no, sorry, I didn't mean, sorry, I don't want to make it sound like I'm going to be dangerous in any way." I would, her wife, actually, she shared, is getting a PhD in like trans theo. I don't think it was theology. I can't remember. We talked very briefly, but she said her wife is currently getting a PhD in some sort of like community mental health or trans issues. And so I told her about my work in the trans community as well. And she looked at me and she said, looked me in the eye and she said, "You're a really cool person." And I have to say, that hearing from my hero, the person, not that we haven't talked about Indigo Girls or Emily very much on this podcast. We'll have to do a follow-up episode in some years from now. But to hear that from the person who really gave me my heart. I don't want to say gave me permission, but who really made me whole, who really said, you are loved for who you are and everything, that did that through her music. That to hear her say that, I walked away being like, I like I said in the beginning, it's time to give back. Like, I really feel like I've arrived at a place of self-possession where I'd like to own what's mine and start to share it with people who are, earlier on in their journeys. Emily did that for me unknowingly. She just kind of shared her gift, which is her music and her songwriting. And, I don't know what my gift is. Maybe it's modeling Jewish values. I don't know. But yeah, my next chapter, I think, in my queer journey is going to be about folding that back in and seeing what it can be like to do that for someone else.
It's really nice.
And if it's okay, because I would really be remiss if I did not quote Indigo Girls, and I could quote hundreds of lines. But the one that I will say is, I actually said this to Emily the other day. We're on a first name basis.
Of course.
I said to her the other day, I said you wrote this line in her song "Come a Long Way" from a few years ago, that she said, "And in a world where every axe was poised to grind, to find my peace, I only held up what was already mine." And this idea where, just to go back to this idea of getting out, that we live in a world where every axe is poised to grind. Not day to day, we hopefully feel loved and supported, but the world is not always friendly to people of difference, people of unique backgrounds, people who speak out loud and live out loud. And in a world where that's true, the most powerful thing you can do is take what's already yours and lift it up and let it shine a light. And we kind of had a hug over that moment, because I think she said something like, "I wrote that? Oh yeah, I did write that." And I took that to mean that she was saying, like, that's just such a true statement for me that I forgot I even put it in a song, because it's just kind of the Emily doctrine. That's how I live. And so it was really nice to have that moment. I said to her, my therapist, who wasn't necessarily a fan before this, knows that line now, because it's become kind of the slogan of our work together. So, that's kind of one of my offerings now, is borrowing from her this idea that this was always mine. People may have tried to take it from me. They might have tried to put me in a closet and I got out, to say, nope, this is mine. And this beautiful part of me is going to be a light, hopefully, to shine some beauty on the world too.
So nice. That's really great. I think I speaking of like, thinking of just the things that we spoke about, I've always kind of when I've thought about my journey, I always think about like who gave me the permission to be myself and like seeing other people. And kind of what I've been learning from you is that's giving them power, not me power. And so I appreciate that perspective. I'm going to be thinking about that, of like, the idea of role models and like permission, but also who has the authority actually in those moments. So I appreciate that. Yeah, go ahead.
And I just want to say, I just, so that I don't sound totally arrogant, as though I figured all of it out. Of course, it's hard. These quotes that I carry with me, I carry them with me because I need reminders. And there are moments, even recently, when I've, evaded a question because I didn't want to go there with somebody, or because I didn't know how they'd respond. It's a process. I think that's really what support is all about, is that we do need some propping up to be able to do that on a good day, but or on a hard day. So these things are a process, but I think in the moments when I'm able to do the thing that feels the most authentic, that's a day that I can sign off on and say, like, if every day were like this, I could be the best version of myself. So I'm trying. I feel bad that we're running out of time. I wanted to do the rapid fire questions.
We're going to do them right now.
Oh, great. I'm just curious, like, what are they gonna be?
So yeah, we're in the lightning round. So the first few seasons I had all either or questions. I was gently called in that that was too binary. So the majority of these lightning round questions are open-ended, which makes them slightly more challenging to answer quickly. Do your best. It's meant for fun. You can pass. And then there also is one either or question that I could simply could not remove. And you'll see what it is when we get there. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Where's your favorite place to think?
Oh my Lord. My favorite place to think is on a bus, a moving bus.
Wow. All right. All right. Who is an influential queer person in your life?
We've used Emily Saliers, and she is in a category of her own. So I won't name her again. I will say Andrea Gibson, her of blessed memory, a poet who her words, if you haven't read them, their poetry is just it's just not of this world. So Andrea Gibson, who passed away recently, they are a person who whose queer way of queer living will live on through me and through others.
Amen. Have you seen Come See Me in the Good Light?
I saw it, I cried through it, I felt inspired by it, I took lessons from it. You know, that documentary, if you haven't seen it, folks who are listening, really, really life-changing stuff.
Yeah, really just amazing. Okay, what is a song that you can listen to on repeat forever?
Oh my Lord. You want me to pick a single song? All right. Well, I've over-indexed on Indigo Girls, which is not really something I actually do. So I won't actually say that. But just to give some diversity here to my taste, Keep Marching, Shayna Taub from the musical Suffs. You know, I'm a cantor, so I feel like I should be singing right now. But I don't want to. You know, it's early and I haven't warmed up and I don't want to take from that song what isn't mine, but keep marching. Your ancestors are all the proof you need. The progress is possible, not guaranteed. It will only be made if we keep marching on. I mean, the lines from that song, I'm getting the chills even speaking about it. I have my Suffs Keep Marching banner flag right here next to me while we're talking, so keep marching.
I love that. I saw Shayna at an ICE protest a few weeks ago. I didn't say
Standing her
anything to
power.
her, but I saw her.
Well, you and I are different in that I saw her recently and I went up to her and we talked and she said, you know, she was very gracious, very lovely. For my 40th birthday coming up, I'm trying to actually book her for a dinner. We don't know if this is possible, but just to be able to say, like, can I have some like time with you to just pick your brain? Because you are truly a genius living on human, living in human form.
Good luck. I hope you get what you wish for.
Thank
So what's one thing you want to be known for?
These questions, I thought they were going to be like, what's your favorite food? What do I want to be known for? I want to be known for an earnest attempt to do my best by living the values that were passed down to me by the people who came before me, my ancestors, my Jewish ancestors, people who came before me in the queer community. I want to be known for doing my best to inherit those values, those lessons, that wisdom, to take care of it, to take care of all those things while I have them, to do right by them, and then to pass them on to be taken care of by other people.
Lovely. Where do you find joy?
Where do I find joy? I have two little nibblings. My sister's kids. I'll show you a picture. You Dubs, not the crowd, but you can imagine just how sweet they are
Aw,
with their red
adorable.
hair. I find joy in their curiosity. My niece is in a stage where she's wondering what a boyfriend or and a girlfriend are, and she's learned, I assume, on the playground to say "ew," not because of gender, but because of being close to another human, and kissing is gross and cooties and all those things.
Yeah,
But
of course.
she'll say to me, you know, she'll my nephew's too young, but my niece will say to me things like, she's asked about a husband, you know, she'll say things like that. And I'll take that moment as a way to meet her curiosity with not pedantic or condescending language, you know, how do you not know this already? Or, well, let me teach you, you know, but more to say, you know, Some people have husbands, some people have wives, some people have partners or spouses who are not, defined by their gender, and so the language isn't gendered. Some people don't marry because they're in relationship in a different way or in a way that works for them. And I challenge her in that way, and I have to say her curiosity has blossomed because of it. There was a possibility that she felt too scared to continue to ask, but I think nurturing that in her has brought me joy.
It's so lovely. All right. Last question. Ready?
I'm ready.
Bagels or donuts?
Oh my Lord, bagels. I am not a sweets person. Both my sister and I, we neither one of us has a sweet tooth. I am like a mozzarella stick kind of person, like after a meal when people are like, I just need something sweet, and I'm like, I just need something salty. So bagels all the way. Donuts, I will eat them, but I can't say I ever really crave them. And also, I mean, what can you say about bagels? They are our people's greatest gift to our, I think, to our tradition. Other than the own egg with the cheese and the wine, I think that the bagels really they really seal the deal.
Amen. Couldn't have said it better.
Amen.
This was lovely. Thank you so much for joining me, for sharing, and thank you for coming out. Let me, you know what? All right. Thank you for getting out.
Thank you for having me, for holding me, for being in community with me, for getting me out and getting me in. So thank you so much.
Nice.
Thank you for coming out.